I'm Mike Vardy, and this is the Productivityist Podcast. Welcome to the Productivityist Podcast. I am your host, Mike Vardy, and with me this week is the author of The More of Less, a friend of mine, Joshua Becker. And I say he's a friend of mine. We've only had a chance to see each other whenever we're traveling, whether we're speaking or attending the same events. But I feel like I've had a chance to get to know Joshua. And this book of his, whether he was my friend or not, I got to tell you, it's a phenomenal book. I highly recommend you check it out. And I don't want to dive in too much into what we discuss right off the bat. But let's just say that there are very few books nowadays, I would say probably one out of every 10, that I take action on a step-by-step basis as I go through the book. The More of Less was one of those. And when you think about minimalism, you're going to hear exactly what Joshua thinks about it. You're going to hear, what my process has been. You're going to get to see what this book can do for you. So, and he's got a lot more to offer as well. So I highly recommend that you check it out. But first, let's check out this episode. Let's check out my discussion with Joshua Becker from Becoming Minimalist and the author of the new book, The More of Less, here on the Productivityist Podcast. Enjoy. I'd like to welcome Joshua Becker to the Productivityist Podcast. Thanks for joining me, Joshua.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So this book that I am holding in my hands right now, I got an advanced reading copy from you. Thanks for sending it my way. It's called The More of Less, Finding the Life You Want Under Everything You Own. I have read a lot of books for somebody who studies productivity and has like a lot of stuff that they've thrown on their to-do list. I've read several books, I would say, on the idea of minimalism, right? And this book, out of all the ones I've read, has had the largest impact on me, the greatest impact. And I'm not saying that because we know each other and we've spoken at events and stuff. I'm saying this because I look at the amount of dog earing that this book has had, and I would say about every six pages, there's something that's dog eared. Now, my flaw is that I should have highlighted it when I did that. So now I have to read it again, which is not a bad thing. But this book is, I want to dive into the idea behind why you wrote The More of Less in the first place, because you had other books in the past, which we'll showcase as well in the show notes. But what prompted you to put The More of Less from, the ideas that you've had in your head? Because the first story in the book, I actually saw you convey a bit at Think Better, Live Better. But what prompted you to put this out there in book form in this particular fashion? Because you have covered some of it before, but this is really, it's not a difficult read at all. So why don't you share that with my audience now?
Well, there's probably a lot of answers to that question. Probably the shortest way to answer it is the book that I wrote called Simplify, which is the first book that I wrote about minimalism. I wrote about a year and a half into my personal journey, and it's relatively short, maybe 40 pages or so. This book, The More of Less, is written 8 years after beginning the process of minimalism, writing about it and speaking about it, basically living every day of my life thinking about it. And so I went back to the very early stuff that I wrote, and I think this book has much more maturity and depth to it. I've become pretty familiar with the questions that people ask, the misconceptions that they have, the obstacles that pop up in people's lives right away. So that was the hope with this book and the need to write something much more comprehensive than stuff I'd written in the past.
Now, I want to touch on what happened as I was reading this book, because I think this is the knowing what I know about you, and we've had a number of times where we've chatted. World Domination Summit, last year we sat while at Jeff Goins. I always say Goins because there's a Toronto Blue Jays player named Goins. It's Goins. Jeff, we're at his meetup, and we just sat and chilled and enjoyed that time. And I think as I started to read this book, and I went through the idea of how do I incorporate this into my life, not just in terms of productivity, because I want to get touch on that a bit in terms of how this relates to the to-do lists that people put together and all the ideas that they have. But I started to think about all the stuff that I had. And my idea behind what minimalism meant, likely incorrectly, in fact, definitely incorrectly, the more I read the book, was about having less stuff. And that's not really what minimalism is it? Entirely, I would say.
Sure. I think, in broader strokes, minimalism is about intentionality. It's about being very intentional with the things that we own. But more than that, it's being intentional with the life that we're living. And what are we striving for? What are we hoping to accomplish with the one life that we've been given? And I usually think that there aren't very many people, probably zero, that I've sat across the table from and had a conversation about what do you really want most out of life? When we think about that question, when we ask that question, no one answers, my greatest goal in life is just to own as much money and own as much stuff as possible, right? I mean, when we dig a little deeper into our hearts and into our souls, we talk about significance and influence. We talk about being good fathers and good spouses and making a difference, right? That's what we want to accomplish with our lives. But somewhere along the way, or maybe I should say all along the way, the world with this constant messaging and constant marketing and advertising that we need to own more, that we'll be happier if we own more, that we'll be more fulfilled if we own more, begins to hijack our passions. And suddenly we begin living lives where, without even realizing it, we're constantly desiring or pursuing bigger houses and nicer cars and, you know, a more robust wardrobe and cooler technology. And all the while, I think if we're to be intentional with ourselves, we know that's not what we most want in life. We've just been so wired into that direction that we don't even realize that we're pursuing those things more than we even want to deep down.
So when you think about it, one of the things that I recognized as I was going through the process of the book, it wasn't just about the stuff, the physical material things, you know, the things that that I have physically, I can hold on to, I can touch, but it's the stuff that's going around in my head, you know, or the stuff that I've put into my to-do list and that I've said, hey, these are things that I may want to do someday. I think one of the things that the book conveys, at least to me, and hopefully to those of you who are listening that will read it, is the idea of letting go of stuff that is less. It's not as tangible. Do you know what I mean? Like it's not the ideas of things that you want to convey. One of the things that you brought up was the idea of you had something that there was something that a hobby that you were pursuing that you were gonna the golf clubs. It was the golf clubs story in the book, right? Where you had these golf clubs in your garage. And you had kept them for a very long time. Now, how often do you golf again? Do you remember how often you golfed?
I was living in Vermont, and I was golfing maybe once or twice a year. Not very often.
And were you golfing because you saw the clubs and were like, I should probably go and use these? Or was it just like, oh, good, I can golf because I have these things?
You know, there's a part in the book that I'll relate this to where I write about Dave Bruno.
Yep.
And he takes on what he calls the 100 thing challenge, where he's going to get down to 100 items. And he talks about the hardest thing for him to get rid of with this self-imposed challenge was he had to get rid of the woodworking tools out of his garage. And he remembers selling them and seeing him drive off and how difficult it was. And he said, What made it so difficult was that it was the death of a dream. He said I always wanted to be a really good woodworker, and those tools represented that. But in reality, I'm I'm not. In reality, I dreamt about them far more than I actually used them. And relating it back to the golf club story, I enjoyed golf. I liked golf. I wanted to be, right? Like, I wanted to think of myself as this, you know, really good golfer that could go out with all the corporate executives on any, you know, given afternoon and, you know, and schmooze some salesmen, even though I was a pastor at the time, right? But that, you know, And giving them up in the moment was difficult, but in reality, it was about I was able to give up this vision of what I thought I could be, or how would I rephrase that? Given up the dream of what I thought could be true about myself, and instead embracing who I actually was and what I actually do well and where I do succeed in life, and just being more intentional about who I actually was. I had a real quick, someone was I had spoken at a conference, and they came up to me afterwards and they talked about books and how hard it was for them to get rid of books. And he said at one point, he said, I looked at my shelves full of books that I had that I hadn't read. And he said, it dawned on me that I've always wanted to be a book reader, but I'm just not a book reader. And so I'd keep all these books almost as a fake me, or to convince myself that I'm a book reader. He said, but in reality, that's just not how I consume information. That's not where I find information. And so, reconciling who we actually are and who we want to be and what's worth pursuing and what's distracting us from what we actually could become and actually what we could accomplish.
So for me, the story was my guitar. So I had an Ovation guitar, and it's been gathering dust for years. And I was going through the book, and that's the story that came to mind. When you were talking about the golf club story, I was like, well, you know, I used to play guitar. I still could play guitar. I play like campfire guitar, where, you know, the fake chords and all that stuff, where you could, you know, get by. And I thought about it. I'm like, you know, I was keeping the guitar because what if I wanted to sit down and play guitar and practice? Or what if, like, a whole bunch of what ifs. And what I found was, is that it was just there. It never happened. I mean, on a weekend when I would, family time, which is, I wouldn't sit and play guitar. I'd play with my kids, you know, or I'd go do something with my kids. So I just decided, you know what, I'm not going to be that guy. That's not where my time will go. That's not where I'll invest my time. So let's give it or sell it, and you've got several different things in the book, which we won't really get into, but in the book, you talk about the ways that you can, you know, remove some of this stuff from your life. And I put it on Craigslist, and someone came by and they almost immediately wanted it. And it was for somebody who was learning how to play, and they really wanted to. And the money I got for that, which was far less than what the guitar was initially worth, didn't matter to me. It mattered that I had I'd freed up my time and given somebody else that time. And it's the same thing with other things that I've already started to remove out of my life. Now, that to me removes decision fatigue as well, right? Do you know what I mean? And is that something that most people don't underrate, or they don't really consider when they are in the process of adopting a more minimalist life, is the fact that they're removing some of that decision fatigue from the equation?
Yeah, and not just decision fatigue, although that's a great point. It's almost I really should be playing that guitar, right? Like it, yeah. Like it's constantly kind of weighing on you, man. I really should be using my boat that I bought, and that I paid for, and I have it.
So you have you put it on the water way far away from where you see it, and then you only drive by there like once every month. You're like, oh yeah, I have a boat there.
Yeah. You know, I think it kind of it just removes that. I mean, almost a little bit of guilt or kind of weighing on you of, gosh, I really should do that. I really should do that when I have time. And it just allows you to embrace who you are. And the reality is that maybe you do want to pick up guitar again at some point in the future. And if you do, then you'll go find a guitar and you'll invest into it. You know, you'll invest the money, you'll invest the time. But at this point in your life, you know, just because it made you happy in the past doesn't mean you have to hold on to it forever.
Well, and I think it's the same thing. I used to do theater and comedy a lot. I haven't stepped on stage to do any of that stuff in a while. And I've reconciled with myself that when I'm retired or the kids are grown up and I don't, you know, that may be a time where I pick that stuff up again. So I think, again, that intention, which is such a huge aspect of it, because you can, and you mentioned about this with family members, because, you know, my wife is, she hates clutter, but she's very much on me about some of the stuff that I've been keeping over the years. I had three boxes of memorabilia, and I know you talk about this in the book as well, from my youth, from like conferences I've been to and pictures I've taken and all that. And I went through that and I'm down to one box. And I did that. And now I didn't do that. Probably should have been one of the things I tackled last, but it was the thing that was weighing on me the most. I would look up in our hallway. We have these built-in shelves and drawers, and there's just the way the storage is, there's a storage cabinet at the very top that only I can reach, and I have to stand on a step stool to get to that. And we call it the dead body storage because it looks like you could put a dead body inside of it. That's what we just call it. And inside of it is literally, and I guess it's kind of a fitting metaphor, because all the stuff up there is the past of me, you know, like some of my past life stuff. And I went from three massive, like I'm talking computer boxes, like not laptop, but we're talking old school desktop boxes full of just stuff, down to one. And it felt so good, not only to eliminate it, but to go through it at the same time. And I think that's one of the things you mentioned in the book, right? Is it's not just the idea of elimination, but it's the processing at the same time, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, Randy Alcorn says every increased possession adds increased anxiety onto our lives. And I usually make the case that everything we own takes up physical space in our lives, but it also takes up mental space and it takes up emotional space. And we don't even realize how much mental space our things take up until we begin to remove them, and we suddenly find freedom, this very, you know, hard word to define, freedom. But like, that's legitimately the emotion that you feel as you begin removing some of these things that that aren't needed. One of the things that I think are very telling, or is very probably difficult but helpful, is when we began removing things. We had about, I took a van load of stuff to Goodwill and it felt great. And I took a second van load of stuff to Goodwill and it felt good. By about the third van load of things that I took to Goodwill, I started asking myself some pretty difficult questions. Like, why do I have three van loads of things in my home that I don't need, right? Why do I have three boxes of memorabilia stored on this upper shelf of my cabinet when it isn't benefiting my life in any way? And as we remove those things, we're forced to ask some of those questions, and some people are scared of them, and some people stop decluttering when the questions get too difficult. But I think the people who succeed, the people who find out the most about themselves through the journey, are the ones that ask the questions of, why is this important to me? Why am I holding on to it? Can I remove it? Really, the journey is as much inward as it is outward, I think, in a lot of ways.
I want to talk about time and commitment and stuff, because that's a lot of what my listeners will relate to. And one of the things you say in the book is, a busy life is an unreflective life. And one of the things I come across a lot when I'm dealing with clients through coaching, or even when I've been developing my productivity methodology and all the stuff that we've been working on here at Productivityist, the idea of looking back so that you can move forward in a more progressive and prosperous way, it's the thing that falls on deaf ears. It's the, well, I don't have time to review, I don't have time to journal, I don't have time to be grateful, because you talk about gratitude in this as well. What do you recommend to people when they're trying to declutter or minimize or kind of put themselves in the proper perspective so that they are really, you know, making the time for the things that they really love to do, as opposed to just going through every day with the busyness of life, because that word busy has become a death knell for so many people in terms of fulfilling and meaningful living experiences.
Well, I think there's a lot of questions that people should be asking themselves if they're constantly hearing about busy and thinking, oh yeah, that defines me. And I think the first question is, are you just in a busy season, or are you living a busy life? Because I think there is time and there is space and there are seasons where we're and not seasons like 18 months long, but I mean, I think there are seasons where we're busy. We're going through in America, you know, tax season is April 15th. And so like accountants are busy for, a couple months leading up to April 15th. And so the first question is, are you just in a busy season, or have you been busy for, 12 months and now it's time to reevaluate? The second important question that people need to answer or ask themselves is, if I am busy, what am I busy about, or why am I so busy? So many people are busy just because they want more money. Like, it is about, I'm busy at work. I'm working my tail off so that I can get the promotion. I can get the raise so I can, build my business to this level and reach a certain income. And this becomes the desire for it. But meanwhile, most of us have enough, we have enough money, we have enough stuff. It's just this constant race to accumulate more and more than we actually need that is contributing to our busyness. And so I would start with those two questions. And then, if they're settling on, I guess I am busy for some unhealthy reasons. Maybe it's not money. Maybe it's prestige or accolades or fame or power, whatever it is that they're striving for. And then just taking a step back and saying, okay, how can I realign my life around things that actually matter and things that are actually going to last? And what does that look like? What are some very practical things that I need to remove, that I can remove, very easily and quickly to free up some of that time?
As you were mentioning that, I was thinking about the Derek Sivers talk from World Domination Summit last year in 2015, where he talked about the three reasons that people do what they like. They become entrepreneurs either for fame, for fortune, or for freedom, right? And in a lot of cases, I chose to do what I do because of freedom. But you're right, sometimes that stuff, like if you're misaligned, it can lead you down the wrong path. Now, I want a new Tesla. Okay, this is going to sound bizarre. You're like, wait a minute. And I know in the story you mentioned somebody who wants there's some story about people who want something that maybe, may fly in the face or seemingly fly in the face of minimalism, or intentional living. And so the new Tesla announcement went out, obviously, as we're recording this a couple of weeks ago. And, I was sitting at the coffee shop with a friend of mine, and I saw the older Tesla come up. And I looked at him like, that's the vehicle I want. We've been living with a 2002 Ford Focus since probably 2002. So is it wrong for me to want a Tesla? And because that's one of the things, and I know that's not how the book made me feel, by the way. It's just, it makes me think about it, because that's something that goes a bit of a conflict is, I would like to have a Tesla, but is there, what else could I do? Like, should I mean, the idea for me, the conflict is, do I go buy the new one that you put $1,000 down and it basically it's a giant crowdfunding project at this point? Or do I look for a used Tesla or what? Like, is it okay for me to want that, and not only that, but pursue that? You're like, no, I wouldn't want a Tesla. You're greedy. Why would you want a Tesla?
Well, let me try and judge your intentions from across the microphone here. look,
how do you reconcile that, I think, is the key question here.
Okay. So first of all, probably one thing that surprised me very early on about minimalism. So I'll answer your question with a yes and a no. How about that?
That works.
I found very early on, interestingly so, that minimalism and frugality are not the same thing. So when I talk about becoming minimalist and the joy of owning less and how it frees us up and frees up time and energy and money and focus and to do whatever, you know, whatever we're most passionate about. That doesn't mean that you have to buy the crappiest of everything. Okay. It's actually the opposite. If you're just going to own a couple pairs of pants rather than 12 to 15, then you can spend more money on nicer pairs of pants that you like and you enjoy wearing and that fits you correctly. So there is a part of it, of minimalism. And there are some very wealthy people who would define themselves as minimalist, but they have very nice, very expensive things. So with that as the mindset, hey, if you need a car, right, and the Tesla's the car that you want to get, then I don't see any problem with it. If it's your fourth or fifth car, I might wonder if you actually need to need to own it. But if you need a car to get around and you're not spending money on other things, so you have money available for this vehicle, then I say go for it and consider it a benefit of minimalism. I do have a section in there on cars and on vehicles and how certainly in America, probably around the world, oftentimes the goal of car purchases or the pursuit of vehicles has nothing to do with transportation, but has everything to do with prestige or reputation, right? That's the desire behind the pursuit of the vehicle.
Yeah,
that they're
like
buying.
If you drive around with a Tesla, then like, ooh, look at the guy with the Tesla, right? Yeah.
Or right, like if that's your motivation, then I would say maybe that's not the best motivation. But if you're like, hey, I need to have a car. We're replacing our car. The Tesla's really fascinating to me. I think it would be a nice car to drive. Then I'd say go for it. But who am I to judge?
It's the reason that I asked that. It came across me when I was sitting there. And actually, it's funny because I was talking to my friend, and he's an electric car owner as well. And sometimes you can crap rationalize, right? You can say, okay, well, but if I get this, and this is the reason why. And actually, a lot sometimes it makes sense when you start to really think about it. But most people just have this desire, like the Tesla's the new hot thing, or whatever the new hot thing is, the Apple Watch or whatever it is. I want one because it will bring me this, it will bring me that. We often just buy things, and you talk about this with the idea of consumerism and the messages that get sent in the book as well. I have no need for an Apple Watch. It's one of those things where I see it and I'm like, you know, I don't wear a watch now. Why would I buy one to wear a watch? The only reason I could possibly justify it is the fitness component. But if my phone is in my pocket all the time, I'm probably getting that anyway. And maybe I'll buy something a little bit more, honestly, the Withings or something like that might be more beneficial, but I don't really need it. And you talk about the idea between, how do I tell the difference between a need and a want? And this is interesting because as I was reading that part, I'm like, the now your method is about dealing with the things that you need to do, the N, deciding on the things you ought to do, and that, which is where we often get stuck, and then ultimately doing more of what you want to do. So how do your answer, and you say this, is if you try doing something without something for a while, rather, that's your answer. How did you come to that? Like, I mean, because a lot of people get stuck in this middle phase. Well, is this a need or is this a want? How do I make the decision? How do I, like, I want to check Facebook. Is that really a deep want, or is it more of a, are you kind of cheating along the way? Like, I think this has a lot to do with intention as well, right?
Oh, sure. I'll talk about it in terms of possessions, but certainly I think it applies to our schedule and sure. Almost every habit of our life, really. Mm-hmm. I stumbled onto experimenting very, very early on, and it was my cable bill went up. And it was a summertime in Vermont, and my cable bill went up, I don't know, $15 a month or something. And I'm like, why am I paying this much for cable? Let's just cancel it. Like, I'm sick and tired of, let's cancel it and let's see what happens. So we canceled our cable and we went several months without it and we loved it. Like, it was great. We found that we just started spending more time as a family. We started being outside more. We got involved in other things. I started doing more reading. I started writing. Like, life was just better without cable. I didn't necessarily know it was going to be. I just wanted to test it out. I was almost forced into it, and yet I loved it. And so I did it with clothing. I had minimized my clothes. I went to like half the closet that I had before, and Courtney Carver's Project 333 pops up, where all these people are just experimenting for 3 months with 33 articles of clothing. And at first I'm like, holy moly, I could never go down to 33 things. Then I'm like, well, it's just 3 months. Maybe I could test it out. And so I tested it out, and I found after the 3 months, I like very early on that I loved it, that I thought I needed 50 or 60 things in my closet. But in reality, 33 felt so much better and nicer, and I enjoyed everything about life better having less clothing. But I wouldn't have known that until I tested it out. One of the things that we had done when we moved here to Phoenix was we went from 2 cars to 1 car. My wife and kids, my kids have school and my wife has her life, and I was working at the time about 10 miles away. And we're like, I don't feel right writing about minimalism having 2 cars. We should probably go down to one. And so we went down to 1, and just to test it out, to experiment with less. And we found out that it didn't work for us, that my wife was running all over the town, picking me up at work, picking the kids up. And so then we realized, okay, you know what? It doesn't work. It was more burdensome to just have 1 car than it was to have 2. But in each of those examples, it was a time of experimenting and testing and seeing, you know, could I go for this Facebook example, right? Like, could I be okay with just 20 minutes on Facebook every day, or could I go an entire week without Facebook, right? Like, you test it out and you come back and you're like, okay, I actually do need a little more time, but you know why, and you're a little more purposeful about what you're trying to do and how you're trying to use it.
Now, let's talk, before we wrap up, we only got a couple minutes left, about the hope effect, because you mentioned that in the book as well. And there are some of the proceeds are going to the hope effect. Why don't you share with everyone here what the hope effect is and why you started it? Because it's a really cool initiative.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks for the opportunity. The Hope Effect is a nonprofit organization that is changing how the world cares for orphans. Most people, when they in developing nations, when we picture orphanages, most people have a mental picture of what an orphanage looks like, right? 30 or 40 kids, a couple adults, in this square building somewhere. And the problem is that we've actually known for decades that this type of environment is actually pretty harmful for children, just because they don't get the interaction and attention and affection that kids need from a very young age for their brains to develop correctly. And so these orphanages, where they're this traditional orphanage where there's large child to adult ratios, most of the kids age out behind in every stage of human development. And so we signed this contract to write this book, write a second book as well. And we're content. Like, I have what I need. I'm not buying a lot of stuff. I don't want to buy a lot of stuff. And so I feel like I had this influx of money. Pardon me. This influx of money that could be used for something else far more significant. And so we used it to start the nonprofit, the Hope Effect. And our book advance money is funding all the administrative expenses behind the organization, so that 100% of donations can be used immediately and directly for orphan care, where we are building smaller housing units. And so in each housing unit, we'll have 8 children and 2 adults. And so in this way, it functions like a family. It acts like a family. Kids get the attention and affection that they need. Also, they get just a picture of what a family looks like for when they age out and when they begin their own.
That's awesome. I think it's phenomenal that you guys are doing that. And I think it's phenomenal that you've got a lot of ways to help people find value in the more of less. Joshua, it's been awesome talking to you. In the show notes, I'm also going to show your Uncluttered course, which I think is also awesome, the online course. I'm going to put that in there as well, just in case, because it's, you can enroll anytime, correct, for that course?
Well, so people who pre-order the book can take the course for free. But Mike, that's May 2nd. That's the last day that they can pre-order the book to get the course for free.
So you have this is intention right now. The only intention you have to pay attention to is to sign up for is to get the book, and then you can register for the course for free. Which is it's I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but I mean, again, with somebody like Joshua Becker, who is so intentional and deliberate and so forthcoming with what you offer, there's the value in there is undeniable. So I check it out.
The course is good. The course helps people apply the principles in the book into their life. And even if they happen to hear this after May 2nd, there's a coupon, a discount code in the back of the book to take the course for a less expensive price. So there's benefit either way.
Awesome. Joshua, where can people find you online when they want to learn more about what you have to offer, which is a whole lot of more, really, when you break it down?
BecomingMinimalist.com is where you can find anything and everything that I do. That's home base for me.
Awesome. Joshua, thanks for joining me this week on the Productivities Podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
So there you go. Now, this is one instance where I won't necessarily talk about where you can get more because it seems like it wouldn't be fitting. But remember that there is some intentional stuff behind becoming a supporter of the podcast and getting a little bit more every single week, whether it's the additional content in every weekly episode, whether it's the bonus episodes, whether it's the perks, whether it's the knowledge that you've been generous, as Joshua mentions, the generosity behind supporting a show that you listen to and that you enjoy. So if you go to patreon.com/productivityist, you can do that, support at whatever level you're comfortable with. But I would rather see you do that for the hope effect. So if you have to choose, please choose the hope effect and give to that organization. Because you know what Joshua is doing with the Hope Effect is phenomenal, and what he's done with this book is equally so. And I think both have huge impacts on people now and will in the future. So again, all you need is in the show notes. If you like this episode, I'd love to see a rating and review. If that's where you'd like to be generous as well, please do so. I'd love to learn how I can make this show better. And if you have any guest suggestions or whatnot, that's where that kind of stuff can pop in as well. Again, I'm still kind of floored with the impact that this book, again, conversational in tone, you know, not a tough read, but yet very powerful all the same. So thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to Joshua Becker for joining me this week. Thanks to John Polstra for producing the show each and every week. And thanks to all of you for listening. That's it. I'll be back next week with another fresh, shiny episode for all of you to enjoy. Until then, I am your host, Mike Vardy, founder of Productivityist, productivity strategist, and father of two, husband of one, reminding you to stop guessing and start going.